Mitchell has been. You okay? Mitchell has been very active in the Adlai Stevenson campaign, and I guess there was a political element in his appointment. But Dewey Bain, Dewey had been at the Richmond Bank, you know, and then he moved to the trip. And he operated with Volcker on the international stuff, and Kennedy appointed him to be board of governors, much to the chagrin of Eddie Wayne. Eddie didn't like that appointment at all.
Well, Bill Martin must have advocated the appointment.
I don't know. I maybe you mean a Dewey Bain? Yeah. Could have. Shepherdson was an older fellow, and he was supposed to be the agricultural representative. There was another guy whose name who was, I believe, from Utah, and I believe he was a Mormon. You know, we usually think of, oh, what's his name?
Eccles.
Beckoning Frontiers.
Sure.
But this other guy was from either Utah or Oregon. We used to sort of make fun of him because I never knew exactly what he was going to advocate. At one meeting he would be very strictly conservative, at the other meeting he would be very liberal. He never could tell what his position was going to be. He didn't stay very long either. But Martin held them all together pretty well. And I liked Martin. He was a very friendly sort of fellow, and I guess he just had a lot of natural leadership talent. He would always talk last at the meetings, and he would always start off by saying, "Well, gentlemen, I don't think we're very far apart on the issue today," or something like that, and then he would proceed to give them what he thought was a consensus, and everybody would agree with him.
But it was his, I mean, he shaped the...
He shaped it, of course he did. Of course he did. And the presidents liked him very much because, you know, he was the one who really started working the presidents. You know, he was the one who started the tri-weekly meetings of the FOMC. He'd be every 3 weeks, you know, and he brought the presidents into the inner family of the Federal Reserve.
Before that, FOMC decisions had been made by a subcommittee of a smaller number, so the presidents weren't really...
That's right. An executive committee on which the presidents were represented, of course. The New York president was always on that. Martin really brought the system together as a unit, including all of the presidents. He was a natural leader, all right, and really, I always liked it. The one occasion on which I had some doubts about Martin as an individual, Howard Hankley was the leading legal beagle up there. Hankley was a very capable guy,
yes.
A real scholar. He's done some very, very good work on the system. They tore into Hankley, and Hankley was such a gentle, nice sort of person, and I just thought it was terrible, abusive of that nice guy.
Wasn't that out of character with
that
Martin?
Out of character, and I remember thinking, while I was listening to that, I said, my heavens alive, oh Lord, Acton was right, Martin has been around too long, and he's had too much power, and he's been corrupted by it.
Well, we'll get to that, because monetary policy really got, I mean, the what we think of as stop-go monetary policy started toward the end of Martin's career. Now obviously, he was under enormous pressure at the time, but the question is whether he changed at all or whether it was just simply a change in political pressures. And
well, you know, Martin was the guy who said that Fed always got a bad press because we always had to take the punch bowl away just when the party was getting good, you know. And I don't know. I think he was quite aware of the fact that the Fed, you know, did tend in the stop-go type policy mode, but I at the very last meeting that Martin presided over,
January 1970,
at the very last meeting, he indicated that he thought we ought to try to aim for a 3% rate of growth in M1. Could you look back on
that? No, I remember that we were moving towards reserves control.
That's right.
Too. We had a target, reserves available to support private.
That's right. The RPDs. RPDs. Well, you see, what's his name? Malcolm Bryan was in on that business of getting some sort of a reserve target. But really, the big experiment with RPDs, I believe, was in the early days of Burns.
But it was really an academic.
Pardon?
It was really an academic kind of experiment in that there was a limit to how far Burns would let the funds rate rise.
And oh, yeah, that's right.
So that.
Well, Burns was a different order of animal altogether from Martin. Both of them. Burns was a much more political person than Martin, although both of them, I think, realized that there was a certain political element in central banking that you simply had to pay obeisance to, you know.
Well, Martin had been in politics ever since
the
end of the 40s. He was head of the Export-Import Bank. So, I mean, I assume...
He was the youngest president of the at New York Stock Exchange.
Right.
I think he was 31 years old or something like that. And then he was in the Treasury for a while, and then he was at the Export-Import Bank. He had been very much in on all of that, and the Accord primarily, wasn't it?
Yes, from the Treasury side.
Yeah, that's right, from the Treasury side.
Douglas from the side of Congress.
Yeah, from the Senate.
But Martin always tried to work with the Treasury.
That's right.
So, well, he had contacts. Yeah, he always got along with people. Presumably,
well,
from
the very beginning, the system worked closely with the Treasury. You know, of course, the Secretary of the Treasury was an ex officio member of the Board of Governors in 1936.
Right.
So all the contacts with the Treasury had been very, very close from the very beginning, and continued even after the reforms of 1936.
But Martin presumably was like Burns, even though Congress was constitutionally charged with the Federal Reserve System, his contacts would have been with the Treasury, not Congressmen, presumably. Yeah.
Well, if you look through some of the Senate hearings in the 1950s, when Paul Douglas was chairman of the Senate Banking Committee, see, Douglas was perennially reminding Burns that the Federal Reserve was a creature of Congress. I remember on one occasion he told Martin that he ought to put on his mirror where he goes to shave every morning a little sign saying, "The Federal Reserve is a creature of the Congress."
Yes. Proxmire continued that tradition.
Yeah, well,
Congress.
Douglas was the guy who really started playing that off.
I suppose the first time Martin really broke with administration policies, or the famous
65.
Example, is December 65.
That's right.
What about earlier periods? The 1960 recession. Do you remember at the time was the Fed blamed for that, or did that come later? The perception that monetary policy had been too.
I don't think the Fed was blamed for much of that because let's see if you. From 57 to about 63, had virtually no inflation in the country. I think the wholesale price index of 63 was lower than it was in 1957. Mm-hmm. And Burns, you know, had been chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors
for Eisenhower, and somehow or other, it seems to me that Burns plus the Federal Reserve were credited, you know, with bringing inflation under control. And I don't remember that the Fed got much of the blame for the recession of 60, which incidentally was a very mild recession. It really wasn't. I think the unemployment rate went up to about 7%. I think my impression is, and that's just when I came to work for the system, and my impression is that most everybody was giving the Fed high grades for keeping inflation under control. And, you know, Kennedy, the election of 1960 was a key election in a number of ways. Kennedy had, you know, there'd been a lot of talk about the economy is dead in the water and on dead center, and the missile gap and miscellaneous other things, and Kennedy had a new frontier arrangement, and he made some remarks that touched off a break in the London gold market. You might remember that.
Yes.
In the autumn of 1960, it occurred. I believe it was after the election. I'm pretty sure it was associated with Kennedy's anyway, things did manage to stabilize there, and we did proceed to recover from the recession, and Kennedy got a lot of credit for that because I think he introduced at that particular time the investment tax credit, which stimulated more investment and helped to pull the economy out of that recession. You might remember that a little bit better than I. You came along with it.
I think I was in high school.
Were you in high school? Yeah, so you...
Was there an understanding at the time of how the Bretton Woods system worked? Looking back at it, you know, one sees 1961 as a pivotal year when there was an economic recovery in the United States, plus a balance of payments deficit of what seemed large at the time, around $3 billion.
Right.
And the Fed raised interest rates somewhat, but only very modestly, less than the Europeans wanted us to. And in retrospect, it was clear that the United States was not going to sacrifice domestic objectives for the discipline of international balance of payments. But at the time, was, you know, would Martin, for example, have understood how the Bretton Woods system worked?
No question about that. A lot of the focus of public attention at that time was on our gold losses, and there was an awful lot of speculation back then on changing the price of gold. And I remember Martin made a big public speech once. As a matter of fact, I was present where he made it, and the title of the speech was "The Price of Gold is Not the Problem." You might remember that some the Frenchman, who was that French economist?
Rueff.
Yeah, not Rueff. No, some other guy. I think it was Josiah Stamp, the Britisher.
Mm-hmm.
They came up with the plans, you know, to increase the price of gold or some such as that. Martin kept arguing, you know, that as a matter of fact, Martin was in favor of raising the interest rate primarily for balance of payments purposes. There was not a lot of popular understanding of the way the Bretton Woods thing worked. There wasn't a lot of popular understanding of the nature, you know, of a gold exchange standard linked to the dollar, with everybody pretty much committed to maintaining parity, some type of parity with the dollar. But our big problems really began there in the 1960s. Actually, I think we started losing gold in the late 1950s. That was more connected with the recovery of Europe and the restoration, you know, of convertibility.
Right.
As a matter of fact, I think most American economists felt that we ought to lose it. was wholesome for us to be losing gold to some of these other countries so they could be in a better position, you know, to maintain the Bretton Woods. So.
Let me ask you, Knight, about an idea of how the Depression shaped attitudes within the Federal Reserve System as opposed to academia. At times I thought that Fed system people attributed to the Depression to the 1920s and to the inflation in the 1920s, which may or may not have occurred, and to speculation. And the lesson that Fed people drew from the Depression was that you needed to stay on top of inflation and speculative credit extension. And academics, of course, kind of Keynesians, reacted very, very differently. And I'm wondering if... it was the people who were on the FOMC in the 1950s. I wonder if it wasn't that conservatism that that concern for inflation that, in a way, made monetary policy as good as it was.
Well, Bob, you know, I remember once upon a time developing a very strong feeling that if Benjamin Strong had been around, we might not have had the Great Depression.
No, I'm sure that's sure that Irving Fisher and Milton Friedman think we would not have.
You mean if Benjamin Strong?
That's right. He would have forced.
I really think that. I would be hard put to document that as a historic statement.
No,
I really believe that Strong had a, you know, a much better handle on what was happening, along with Strong and Montague Norman were very close,
right.
You know, and they had the similar ideas of how to run a central bank and what central banking was all about. Of course, you know, back then they called it sound money.
But there was a competition for control within the system. The board was competing with New York, and New York had control of open market operations, and I think basically Carter Glass, we didn't want to see the Federal Reserve System become a central bank dominated by New York. He and the board basically combined to keep New York from taking an aggressive posture during the Depression, and New York didn't have a leader as strong as Benjamin Strong, so
the system drifted
as a consequence of that division. And,
exactly.
Strong
died at a very bad time.
That's
his start. He died in 1928.
That's right.
Well, anyway, I know the system really did not have very strong leadership. What's his name?
McCabe
was. Not much of a guy from Utah, but his name slips me at the moment. The Beckling Frontiers guy.
Eccles,
that's right. Eccles, Marin Eccles. Never was particularly impressed with Marin Eccles for some reason or other. Were you?
Well, he was a New Dealer.
Yes.
And he was a like Burns, he was a presidential advisor.
Mm-hmm.
But he knew a lot about New Deal programs, but he didn't know a lot about monetary policy. That, you know, he was just a small town banker, but he had an enormous ego and thought he knew how the world worked. But there basically wasn't a lot of monetary policy while he was in office because of the pegging, except for 37-38 when we raised reserve requirements, and that was a disaster. Were there other FOMC members who could challenge Martin? What about Robertson?
Robertson was about the only one, I guess, who, although Robertson was willing to follow Martin. Robertson had little pet projects like unifying the super reg function, you know. You know, there's recent talk about some sort of a centralized regulatory authority. Well, see, Robertson kept pushing that the whole time that he was there. Robertson was a very interesting guy, very articulate, a very good speaker, and he sort of liked the limelight, but he was never a serious challenger to Martin.
What about regional bank presidents? Were there particularly strong presidents? Some have been around for a while. Bope from Philadelphia.
Bope did a lot of writing, and he Bope was a pretty good economist, and the influenced by the Keynesian Revolution. But he was an old timer too, you know. And I guess he had good work, I imagine, in the maybe late 1920s, early 1930s. Mm-hmm. And a bit of writing. I remember reading a lot of his stuff when I was in. Well, there was the New York fellow before Al Hayes.
Spruill.
Alan Spruill was. He was certainly a very influential. But he had left by the time I came. He was still living, and the New York people were crazy about him. I remember George Garvey used to worship Alan Spruill.
Well, he was a straight money market person.
That's
tone,
right.
Tone and feel.
That's right.
That
that's
for
right.
him was that's monetary right. policy. How the market
well,
was feeling.
Well, there was a lot of that. Yeah, that was a fair universal view in the system. Universal, it was, say, a prevalent view. Al Hayes was a very gentle sort of person, very fine person, real gentleman, very soft-spoken, and he made a lot of speeches, and it was very, very frequently quoted, but he wasn't a very vigorous voice in the FOMC meetings. Okay, the meetings were those that I attended in the 1960s were just heavily dominated by Martin. Okay. Made everybody feel like he was part of the game, all right. Yeah. But.
Well, that's an interesting comment, because if you read the minutes, Martin doesn't talk a lot.
Until
it's mostly,
the end.
Yes,
the end.
And then he says, well, I think we see a,
that's
I
right.
think I see a common
yeah, that's right.
ground
we're not
here.
Very far apart today, or
right.
something like that. He just had that nice little personality
yes.
about him that could develop an appropriate consensus, and you had some interesting people. I remember old Watrous Irons, who was president of the Dallas Bank. He talked about tone, feel, and smell of the market, as we used to say. He'd say, "Well, I don't think we need to do a great deal today. I think it might be all right if you maybe raise the federal funds rate an eighth of a point." Like that, and the Treasury bill, 90-day Treasury bill, ought to be trading at around, say, 290, 290. He was ridiculous, you know. I mean, you talk about fine-tuning the market. Boy, I'll tell you, he talked in terms of 4 or 5 basis points, and nobody paid much attention to him. I still can't think of the name of the guy who succeeded Johns as president of the St. Louis Bank.
Well, eventually it was Darrell Francis.
But there was somebody in between.
Right.
But he didn't stay very long. He got a much better job somewhere in the system. Of the presidents, gosh, I don't believe that was a strong one.
Who was the head of the Atlanta Fed?
Malcolm Bryant was the head then.
Mm-hmm.
Bryant was in poor health. I believe he took an early retirement, and they put the first vice president, a guy named Patterson, knowing, you know, that Patterson was an old guy then, pretty mm-hmm. close to retirement. And that was McKinney.
Do you remember any of the details surrounding the December 1965 increase in the discount rate? Martin had been concern for some time
that very well
inflation was coming back.
Yeah. Well, you see, the Vietnam War was picking up, but what happened then was that you had Johnson with a program to push the Vietnam War and at the same time push the Great Society program. Hmm. And Martin just knew damn well we couldn't do both, you see, that this was a definite road to inflation again. As a matter of fact, that's when inflation began to pick up, you know, in middle 1965. Up to that time, we'd had virtually no inflation. From 57 to about 64, I guess in late 64, you could see a pickup in the price indices. And Martin was genuinely worried about it, and so was I. I mean, all of us were. And it was clear that Johnson was badgering the system, you know, to keep interest rates low. And Martin held his ground, even though, you know, he was called down on the farm. And, he really held his ground, and I admired him for it. Went ahead and raised it. And the thing about it is that it was clear that he had told Johnson about raising it. Johnson, you know, tried to make out like it came as just this big surprise to him. The Fed was pulling some fast one on him. But that wasn't the case at all, because I am just as sure as I can be in my mind that Johnson had given, that Martin had given Johnson plenty of advance warning about about that taking place. As it might be shown in the minutes. But it was clear to all of us that this ploy that Johnson was pulling was the rankest kind of politics.
Well, the discount rate would have been discussed at the board, so I don't know if there are any board minutes from that time. Probably there are. But would the full FOMC, would it have discussed discount rate changes?
Yeah.
I know they
wouldn't have discussed it in terms of approving or disapproving, but very frequently they would say, we think that the discount rate ought to be increased or ought to be decreased or something like that. You hear that frequently from the president.
So that was, and Burns and Volcker wouldn't let the FOMC discuss discount rate changes. That's my recollection.
So they wouldn't discuss action on the discount rate, because that was strictly a board thing. But, you know, expressions of views as to what the discount rate ought to be, I'm pretty sure it took place under Burns and Volcker just as it did under Martin. But it was clear that Martin had let Johnson know that interest rates had to go up under the circumstances to keep the economy, you know, on some reasonable, stable path.
The governors were divided, though, weren't they? At least for a while? Or did they follow
back through the annual report of the Board of Governors? Serious division on that story at all. I think it was pretty uniform.
I'll try this and make sure we're getting some.
Shepardson was, you know, I think Shepardson was from the University of Texas, and it seems to me that he was an agricultural economist. And I imagine that somebody like that might have, you know, Texas you usually associate with low interest people anyway, don't you?
Right, Patman. Gonzalez, Lyndon Johnson.
Shepardson might have been opposed to it. And the guy from Utah, I could tell what he was for or what he was against. Overall, Bob, I would have to say that there were some notable exceptions. Robinson was clearly a very capable guy, so was Balderson. But a lot of the governors were, you know, they were political appointees, and they really, some of them, but what was that, Abbott Mills, I believe.
Yes.
Abbott Mills, that's right.
If you can look at monetary policy, the break seems to come in 1967, in that before that time, there had been periods when inflation had risen, but then the Fed had brought it back down. And then, but in 67, that was the first period where the Fed didn't stay with the restrictive monetary policy until it had brought inflation back down to basically zero. Monetary policy became easy before inflation had come down. So that was clearly a difficult year for the Fed. Two things were going on. Martin was up, the chairman's position was up for reappointment. And there was the issue of whether Johnson was going to ask for a tax increase. Do you remember anything about that year and the kinds of...
I believe that was 68, Bob.
Well, 68 was the year they actually passed,
the tax surcharge. Yeah.
And then after that happened, the Fed lowered.
That's right.
And even though money growth was
high... That's what made Dan Brill resign and I didn't know that. Commercial credit. Let's go back just a little bit. There was a credit crunch in 66, you know. And as a matter of fact, there were some people who claimed 66, 67 was a mini recession. You remember that?
Oh, sure, it was. It was. It was almost a
regular recession. You remember the credit
crunch.
A lot was made of the so-called credit crunch, you know.
Oh, sure.
And that, you see,
housing was hurting.
that followed the trip down to the farm,
right,
in December of 1965, when we were really trying to contain the economy, because, as I say, you had a situation of speeding up defense expenditures with the Vietnam War, and then the Great Society program going full blast. It was, you know, it was a question of trying to give the country guns and butter at the same time, and it just wasn't going to work. And the Fed knew that. I'm sure Martin knew that. And they kept plugging away at the administration, you know, to raise taxes. If you're going to do this thing, you're going to have to raise taxes, you know, to finance it, you see. And then they did put on that surtax. I guess they started talking about it in 67. And then Dan Brill and company got to arguing that this surtax was going to have such a deflationary effect that it had to be offset by easing monetary policy. And we started that easing in 1968, I believe. And it just happened, you know, that was also an election year.
Brill was from the Philadelphia Fed.
No, Brill was at the board.
Dan Brill. I guess that's right.
Yeah, Dan was at the board. Dan was a very interesting guy. He died some years back. But I always liked old Dan. I thought, you know, he was involved. Dan was a pretty good economist. You might remember studying the flow of funds accounts.
Yes.
In school. I think Morris Copeland and Dan Brill were the guys who really put that together. Dan was a very resourceful sort of guy. But he was convinced that
they were Keynesians, and they thought fiscal policy the old thing, the IIS schedule is going to shift.
That's right. That's
the
exactly
LM schedule's got to, right. That was the thing. Right. I mean, the board staff was very Keynesian.
Absolutely.
But I don't know whether Martin believed any of that, or whether he had.
I mean,
Congress wanted a reward for having passed the surcharge, and it wanted, you know, something to show for the pain, and it wanted interest rates to fall. And maybe he probably thought that, well, okay, Congress has carried through, monetary policy can be.
Well, I think that's right. I think that was that typified thinking at the professional level, at the level of the professional economists on it, but it clearly turned out to be a mistake. And I think that's why Dan resigned and went over to a much better job in commercial credit and making a lot more money.
He didn't resign because he changed his mind. He resigned because it was realized that he'd offered bad advice.
I think that's it. I think that's it. He was pretty nice. Pretty nice fellow, really.
When we think of the modern Federal Reserve System, it was basically in place when Martin left. Everything think of as characterizing the Federal Reserve System in the post-Accord period, it really all happened under Martin.
That's right. Oh yeah, Martin's the guy who put the system together as we know it today. Now, when Burns took over, Andy Bremer was a good governor. I remember having some doubts that maybe he was appointed just by way of helping Johnson, you know, pull together the black vote. But Andy Bremer was a quite respectable economist, and he did his homework very, very well. And you know, he was a vigorous defender of his positions. They were all, for the most part, Keynesian positions, but he defended them with vigor and pretty convincingly.
Martin didn't like economists per se, did he? I mean, he was opposed to Bremer because Bremer was an academic economist initially. Isn't that the story?
I really don't know. I wasn't aware of that. I wasn't aware of anything about that. Martin, as I said, was a very agreeable sort of person, and I think he had great confidence in his ability to hold it. Martin liked the presidents, and the presidents liked him. And I guess he always felt that he had a good group of presidents who would always be with him, and he didn't mind getting some opposition from some of the board, board staff.
Hi.
The whole situation changed drastically with Burns. Bob Black and I was with Bob Sunday afternoon, and we were sort of reminisced. The first meeting that Bob came to, you know, as after Aubrey died, was in 73. And, I guess Bob was a substitute for Aubrey shortly after Burns took over. As a matter of fact, it might have been Burns' first meeting. I believe it was. And Burns announced at that meeting that we were going to make some changes, and one change in particular that I'm very eager to go ahead and get started with right away. And that is, from now on, at 10:30, 11 o'clock, we're going to have a coffee break. And Bob says, when he announced that some changes were going to be made, he thought surely that he was going to rub the first vice president out.
Sure.
But anyway, George Garvey, shortly after Burns was appointed, George would be an interesting guy for you to interview, Bob. George was a good.
I wrote him a letter once, and I think he died shortly after.
Did he really? He might have died.
Because I tried, because he went all the way back, and I thought, wow, I should talk to him.
He is the guy that you should have talked to, that's right.
Yeah.
And anyway, George, I remember, told me once, we were talking about Arthur Burns, he said, Arthur's favorite mode of conversation is the monologue.
Yeah, well, he wanted the lecture.
That's exactly right. He ran those meetings. He ran those meetings like a graduate seminar. And you knew who was king. It was King Arthur. And he was so different from Martin. Martin always let everybody talk, you know, and very seldom interrupted. His only interruption would be, you know, to call on him by name, usually by first name. Eddie is here. Eddie Wade. Scanlon, the Chicago man, I forget his first name, but he would always call on them. Burns, you know, he'd start one end of the table and go around, the next meeting he'd start the other end, go around the other way, and that sort of thing, you know, and he had it, it was very structured. Everybody had his say when his time came. Martin used to say that, look, if we can't get this thing settled between 9 and 12, we aren't going to get it settled at all. And, you know, you could be sure that the meeting would be over at 12 o'clock with Martin there. We usually would have a lunch afterwards. And Martin would get up and say, well, this is another happy occasion or some such as that. Martin was a very nice personality. Burns was altogether different. We're going to settle this thing. We have to stay here all day. He even started two-day meetings, you know. Burns started those. He wanted to hash things out. Burns, and I always thought that Burns was really one of the best representatives of the best in American institutionalism. I always associated him with Wesley Clair Mitchell, as you know. Not the Veblenian or Galbraithian type of American institutionalists, but the really good the good economist types. And you just aren't very high grades as an economist. And I still think that his statements on policy were about as clear as you could get on them in laying out the nature of the problem. Bob Blank disagrees with me on that. Bob thinks that the Martin was too political in the partisan sense of the word.
Martin?
No, Burns. 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 That's what Bob Blank thinks that Burns was very preoccupied with getting Nixon reelected and that sort of thing.
That's interesting. Burns viewed himself as a presidential advisor, mm-hmm. and so he always wanted to be on regular speaking terms with the president. He wanted to lecture the president the way he lectured everyone else. And I wonder if that desire to be right there at the center of power and to be in on all the major decisions, fiscal as well as monetary policy, if it didn't inevitably involve him in compromises that he wouldn't have made if he had compartmentalized his role.
Well, I think there's a lot to that. I think there's a lot to that, but I also think that Burns was an ideological Republican. I don't think he just didn't like the idea of Democratic presidents in there like Lyndon Johnson and later on the Georgia boy, Carter. He didn't have a lot of trust in the kinds of overall economic policies that the Democratic Party pushed you into. And I think he felt that, you know, the country got along better from the economic standpoint with the Republican administration. And, he might have, although I don't know, I don't remember exactly. I haven't challenged Bob Black on this, but I would like to see somebody document the position that he handled policy in the 71-72 period in a way that helped Nixon get reelected. if you look back over the behavior of the federal funds rate in that period, I think, as a matter of fact, that you might just make the reverse case, that he did not handle policy in a way that helped Nixon get reelected, you know, in the broader political context. After the Democrats nominated McGovern, Nixon must have been having trouble in the election. That's why the Watergate thing becomes so incomprehensible to me.
Mm-hmm. So, about his views as an economist, we think of him as a major in economist, which he was, but now everybody is a neoclassical economist, utility maximizing, profit maximizing, marginal conditions. But he really was preceded that school. He started from a vast study of empirical data,
right.
And he put them together in his own mind in a,
right.
You know, taking account of more of a psychology approach to behavior. I mean, didn't he think that economists' models were too simple to capture the complexity of the world?
Yeah. But that's why I always characterized him as an American institutionalist. Actually, he had a German background too, you know, and I always felt that he had a little bit of a weakness towards, you know, the German Gestalt theory type thing, you know, the much broader type model, like the American institutions, you know, the German historical schools and that sort of thing. He was more German than Austrian, I think, although he grew up in Austria. And I think he associates better with the American institutionalism and the German Gestalt theory and German historical school.
Not too much.
Than with the Austrian, as you call him, Menger, you know. Burns was a very interesting person, as well as a very interesting economist. He was very anti-Keynesian, I'll tell you that. He would have nothing to do with Keynesianism. And he didn't care for the staff. The staff didn't like Burns at all, incidentally. Jim Pierce detested him. And I think the feeling was mutual. Burns really dressed Jim Pierce down good in a couple of meetings up there. Because the staff was very, you know, the ISLM business, you know, and Burns just didn't have any, it wouldn't have any part of that foolishness.
but Burns did believe that you could trade off inflation against unemployment and lower unemployment, because if you look at what he did, most of the time he was willing to accept inflation because he thought that if he didn't, he'd get higher unemployment. So in terms of kind of an expansionary policy, kind of. But, I mean, Burns, the way Burns explains it in his writings is that he views inflation as something that's given to the Federal Reserve System, the power of, the monopoly power of labor unions or irresponsible fiscal policy. Then the Fed has to make a decision. It can accept that inflation rate, or it can raise interest rates and not accept it. And if it accepts it, it gets lower unemployment. If it doesn't, it gets high unemployment. The cruel dilemma. And that's a trade-off. If you're willing to accept inflation, you can get lower unemployment.
My feeling is that the Phillips curve had begun to be questioned by that time, by the time Burns came along. Gosh, I don't know. Bob Black and I used to rail against the Phillips curve all the time back early on, you know. And I don't know. The big proponent of the Phillips curve, I guess, was Dave Eastman more than anybody else. But I seem to recall a dialogue between Eastman and Burns. Where Burns really scolded him for believing in the Phillips curve. I don't know.
Well, but Burns could say one thing just as a way of dominating.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, what he would argue to get what he wanted wasn't necessarily what he...
Well, you know, I think we have to remember the backdrop.
October 73 is when the embargo went. But then it was really 74 when...
Oil prices began to go up, and there was a. I remember Burns arguing back then that the problem is
not too much money.
Not enough oil. That's right.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Of course, at that time Nixon was weak, and then
Ford came
in, and he wasn't dominating. So. At that time, there weren't the political constraints, so that would suggest your hypothesis that the monetary policy we got was not so much Burns trying to trade off on a Phillips curve, but rather it was Burns trying to see what the political system would or would not tolerate and trying to walk a fine line and ultimately being pushed, like a boat that tries to aim for the other shore, but it keeps getting pushed off.
Burns was, what's his name, when Ford came in, you know, he started that WIN program, Whip Inflation Now. You remember that?
Sure.
There was a sort of
buttons you could wear.
Yeah, that's right, the WIN buttons.
Thank you.
But now, Ford didn't last very long, and I don't know, I'm sure that Burns would have preferred that Ford win the election, but Ford wasn't. By that time, you know, the Democrats had completely taken over the Congress.
Well, I mean, Burns really blamed inflation on the political system, right? The welfare state and the kinds of pressures the welfare state,
mm-hmm.
expectations
mm-hmm.
the welfare mm-hmm. state created. And he viewed his role as seeing how much he could challenge the political system, and
he had to validate the inflation tendencies in the political system. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, but then, you know, period by period, the temptation was to try to walk a fine line, and was not a line anybody could walk, really.
Burns was always lecturing the Congress, you know, particularly on fiscal policy. I always refer to him, Bob and I would sort of, we always called him King Arthur for one thing, but I always called him the Apostle of Parsimony. And, you know, some of those congressmen like Royce and...
I just have one copy, that's all.
That's not plenty for me, anything. Royce and Proxmire, and that, they began to turn the tables on him, you know, and they said, look, physician, heal thyself. You've got all sorts of wasteful operations in the Federal Reserve, and the fact of the matter is that we did. We didn't watch our money very carefully in the Federal Reserve when I first came there, and Burns really turned that around. Burns made us very cost-conscious because he wanted to be sure that his house was in order, you know, when he was preaching to the...
Did anyone ever try to challenge him at FOMC meetings? There was really no one of his stature. St. Louis had their own view, but Daryl Francis could never articulate.
I thought of the name of that first vice president. It was Gene Leonard. Mm-hmm. Gene Leonard was a guy.
He wore the Gary shirt.
Yeah, that's right. And he would come with these big, long, crooked cigars and that sort of thing. Anyway, Daryl was... Darren always had a well-prepared statement, and he delivered it very well. Every once in a while, he'd get a challenge from Andy Bremer, and usually it would be a pretty damn good challenge. To, mm-hmm. As I say, Bremer did his homework, and I seldom agreed with him, but you know he would give a good account of himself for high marks as a governor compared with. Some of the other non-entities that we had up there. Else Dewey, I won't be but just a few seconds and we proceed to talk for 10 minutes. he would get a challenge from Volcker when Volcker was president of the New York Bank.
But Volcker wasn't an anti- inflation hawk in that period, was he? He didn't challenge Burns by saying we're going to get inflation. That would have been through 77.
I don't remember that he was much of a... Sometimes he would challenge,
Miller?
No, sometimes he would challenge Burns on a particular statement of the directive. You know, you probably read the blue book, don't you?
Yes.
You still get the blue book.
Yes.
Do they still give you alternatives A, B, C?
Of course.
Yeah. And frequently, Burns would, or rather, Volcker would challenge him on the wording of a directive or something of that sort. But Volcker had very little to say at these meetings for some reason or other, and our impression of Volcker was not all that good when he was president of the New York Bank. Now we had been poisoned somewhat, I think, by Charlie Coombs and some of the others. People like Charlie Coombs and George Garvey, to some extent, although this was especially the case with Coombs, they had a strong sense of loyalty to Al Hayes. Mm-hmm. They liked Al Hayes. It happened that Volcker had come to work for Coombs at the New York Bank, and Coombs didn't like him worth a damn. Coombs was very upset when he was made president of the New York Bank. And I remember walking with Bob, and I walked with Coombs there, and he was really reading the riot act on Volcker.
Why? He thought Volcker was too much of a Washington type?
He just
Treasury didn't. Background?
He didn't specify exactly, but he just didn't like him. He just thought he was a wrong man for the job. But on the other hand, I used to say, I was pretty close to Peter Fusick, who was really a very nice chap, and I had a lot of respect for Peter. And he used to tell me that Volcker was the brightest guy that he'd ever worked for. He said he was just terrific, he said. He would sit there and just listen and listen and listen and not have much to say, and then all of a sudden he'd turn around on you and he would, you know, tell you exactly the way things were. He said he was just remarkable. And the fact of the matter is that he turned out to be that way at the open market meetings. So long as he was president of the New York Bank, I'll tell you the truth, we just didn't see an awful lot there, frankly. We just didn't think that...
Could really have been the first Fed chairman whom we could have talked to about inflation. He thought inflation was a monetary phenomenon.
Yeah.
It was too much money, and it was the Federal Reserve.
Well, I think Burns thought so, too. One of the first things that Burns, when Burns came in, you know, he wanted to follow the Friedman rule.
Burns? That doesn't
sound... Yes, he did. He most assuredly did.
And I thought Burns wouldn't have anything to do with money. I thought he thought velocity was some psychologically unstable creature you couldn't rely on, and you looked at interest rates and credit flows and everything except money.
You look back at those early meetings with Burns. He, you know, that's when you had all these experiments with RPDs and that sort of thing. I remember.
But wasn't that something that was in place from Martin, and it just continued? But Burns moved the system away from that.
Well, he gave up on them. I remember the meeting. He says, "Well, I think right now, from what we've seen from our experiments here, we ought to go ahead and give RPDs a decent burial." He put it just that way. Because Bob Black, you see, was a big supporter of the RPD business, mm-hmm. you see. And,
yes.
and as I was saying, even back in the early 60s, Malcolm Bryan was always touting some sort of a high-powered reserve targeting business. But I believe that, as I recall, the last meeting of... Martin's last meeting. Martin specifically said, "Let's just go over the monetary target and try to achieve a 3% growth in the money supply." And when Burns came in, he validated that. And he, if you look back in the minutes for those early meetings, I think you'll find that he continued to say, "Let's try to get a 3% growth in the money supply." And I think the thing that eventually broke him away from that is the notion that it was extremely difficult to define the damn thing statistically in the first place, and extremely difficult to know how you were getting at the damn thing in the second place. But, you know, we were going through all of that little period there of putting little spaces or intervals around a line that we wanted to get for money growth and that
tolerance ranges,
that's right. And it was just, it turned out to be an extremely difficult thing in our kind of financial system, you know, to specify a thing that gave you a real world equivalent to this thing that we call M1, you know, in theoretical analysis. I think it was that realization that tended to put him on the federal funds rate. But much of the 60s and the 70s, for that matter, were of an experimental nature. I guess we were probably the most experimental of all of the central banks of the world.
I mean, I think you could put it a different way, maybe less generously for his quantity theory views, is that he couldn't get monetary control with the kinds of interest rates he found acceptable. That he realized that you'd need much bigger changes in short-term interest rates to hit targets than he was willing to accept, and maybe that was partly
I would say that it was entirely for political reasons. But Burns was very much an anti-inflation man, and he knew that inflation resulted. He was trying to find some way to. I can't get into the man's mind, which of course is a hell of a lot bigger than my mind could ever be. But I think he had gotten to the point where he looked at the federal funds rate as a sort of valve, you know, that you could open and close and let in, control the amount of high-powered money that you were allowing to get out into the economy. To the point where he trusted that more than he trusted the figures that he was getting on reserves and money growth. I don't know. A speculation. But so far as his identifying money growth and inflation, there's no doubt in my mind that he did. And to him, inflation was as much a monetary phenomenon.
Well, the same, in the fall after he was appointed, I think it would have been fall 1970, he was the first one to advocate wage and price controls. He wouldn't have used that language. He would have said incomes policy. And at that time, Nixon was
Burns was bitterly opposed to price controls.
Well, he said we need an incomes policy.
Well, I remember, and we had a joint meeting with the Atlanta Bank in April of 1971. And at that particular time, the postal workers went on strike. And at about the same time, the Teamsters were threatening to go on strike. And we had a member of the Charlotte Branch Board who was in the trucking business from the Carolina Freight Company. And Burns was very upset. I remember, you know, he used to stand up and he'd do his hands like this when he was talking frequently, and he heard about the postal strike. He said, "This is not a strike. This is insurrection."
Well, he had that European view.
That's
that,
right.
That there was an indiscipline on the part of the masses, and that there was an elite that had to impose a discipline.
Well,
if you turn the world over to kind of unbridled democracy...
No, but I remember the follow-up remark was that this is the kind of thing that makes me think the unthinkable, because, you know, the unthinkable they have up to that time was wage and price controls. And that was when he began to think that maybe we had gotten to the point where some kind of incomes policy was necessary. That happened in 1971. But throughout 1970, he kept saying no wage and price controls. He was very adamant on that score. And at that particular meeting in Atlanta, it was the first time that I heard him say anything like that.
But he
it makes me think the unthinkable, is the way he put it. And the unthinkable to him was some form of income policy.
But I think it was December of the preceding year, he had given a speech at, I think it was Pepperdine College, and he said, mm-hmm. we need an incomes policy. So what did he have in mind?
Just informal
guidelines?
I remember the Pepperdine speech. But and you say that was in December of 1970?
Yes.
I don't know. I don't remember that he came out and say, I heard him say, makes me think the unthinkable because of the way things were going in
In 1973, he was head of the Committee on Interest and Dividends.
Right.
And he was very actively involved in lobbying, I guess that's the word, individual banks and companies not to raise dividends and kind of raise interest rates on small. I mean, that was a very intrusive form of control.
Absolutely.
So presumably he viewed that as the... as a better alternative than you know, controls imposed by Congress?
No, the controls had been imposed before that time, you know. 71 is when we closed the gold window and started...
Right, but the banking system wasn't subject to those controls. That was the issue.
I was on a committee with Steve Axelrod on that, you know, on the interest and dividends, on the interest and dividends thing, and... this was always an element in Burns's attitude towards the federal funds rate, you know, the interest and dividend control thing on it. So, and it was, as you say, a very intrusive thing, particularly with respect to the regulation of bank dividend and interest policy of individual commercial banks. So I don't know. The whole thing got tangled up into the monetary policy prescriptions also. So I don't know. My own feeling is that all of that was very much out of the Burns character. It's something that he did purely as a political expedient, just having to go along. That is with the political current of the time. Whatever you say about price and wage controls. They were very popular at the time. They were very popular. All of our directors, for example, had gotten to the point where they felt like some price and wage controls were absolutely necessary. And of course, what they had in mind was wage controls.
Yes.
more than anything else. But, you know, we were
dogmatically opposed to them at the bank. Bob and I and all of us were dogmatically opposed to price and wage controls.
Did Burns explain the Camp David meetings in August 1971 where they closed the gold window and adopted wage price controls? Did he brief the FOMC on that meeting? And I wonder how he defended the outcome of the meeting, his role in
it. I don't remember him specifically, Burns, that some open...
That was the Fortune magazine article.
That's
by
right.
Pete Rose. And
that's
apparently
right.
There
right.
was a lot of heated discussion, and there was a break, and Burns retired with his advisors. And the story is that...
I was at that meeting, Bob, and nothing like that happened.
I'm sure he huddled with his advisors.
Well, he might have, during the coffee break or something like that, you know, he might have gone out with somebody. But then the notion that he came back in and ordered the committee to do something that the committee was opposed to is absolute fiction.
Or the idea that he would have phoned the White House. That was absurd. I don't know. The story was that Leonel...
The story was fiction. I'll tell you, I have a pretty good idea of how that story got started.
It was Anderson from St. Louis.
Anderson from St. Louis is the guy who, I think, planted that that notion. Andy left the system shortly after that. You might...
Right.
Pardon?
Right, he went to Florida, I think.
Somewhere. Well, Andy was... It was a shame, because Andy was pretty damn good.
He was very bright, yeah.
Yeah, very, very bright. I liked it very much, and... I thought he did some very good work on monetary control and that sort of thing. He did much more solid work than Homer Jones did. I liked him, but he had that little way about him, you know. And he didn't like Burns, and you know, he just felt it was too political. And I think he must have talked to some people. I was on a program down at Hilton Head with the editor, with him about that story. And I told him, I said, you know, frankly, I was there, so far as I'm concerned. That's the way of getting at these things. And he said, we did a lot of research on that, and we just put together a little bit here, a little bit there, a little bit here, and we stand by that story. I said, well, so far as I'm concerned, you're standing by pure fiction. But he apparently was ready to defend it. And I believe probably the guy that he got most of that stuff from was Andy Anderson.
Burns always wanted to communicate with the president, and he was willing to adjust the timing of things. And when you adjust the timing, you always do it in one direction. I remember a meeting in spring of 1977 where we got a memo from the board pointing out that we were always missing our money targets on the same side. And we went up to the meetings very excited that we were going to push the funds rate up. Mm-hmm. And that's the one we should have done it, early in 77. And we got up there, and Burns had just gotten back from a meeting with the White House on the energy program, and he says, "Oh, we can't disturb markets now because you know when the details get out about this program, the markets will be unsettled." And so he was trying to walk a line between.
Yeah. I remember during Burns's tenure. You know, I think Burns had been a professor of Milton Friedman's at Rutgers.
At Columbia.
At Columbia? Homer Jones had also been an instructor.
Yeah, at Rutgers.
At Rutgers.
Yeah.
That's right. Well, anyway, I remember thinking, after Burns had been there a while, because he started off with his 3% rate of growth of money, you know, and that sort of thing. I remember thinking a good subject for a cartoon would be somebody with a great big bottle labeled Federal Reserve, and Burns on the inside looking at Friedman on the outside and saying to Friedman, "But it looks different from inside." And that's the impression that I had of Burns, you know, that he started off really very much in that mode of keep the rate of growth of money in 3, 4, 5% range. And then he discovered that, you know, as a political matter, it just was extremely difficult to do that. And I think he started playing along with the politics of the situation. I don't know, that is an individual impression, you know.
That's right.
Incidentally, on the Pete Rose article, shortly after that article appeared, there were two letters to the editor published in Fortune, one by Andy Brimmer and one by Governor Robertson.
Well, Milton Friedman wrote a letter to the Wall Street Journal saying that this could not have happened.
Yeah,
so that was generous, because Burns and Friedman broke over the wage and price controls.
That's right. They did break over that. But anyway, Brimmer said that is pure fiction, and he was, you know, just exactly the same impression that I had. And I believe Governor Robertson said the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know, but a lot of people still believe it, apparently, you know.
Well, if you go back and you read the congressional hearings from that time, the whole political system, Democrats, Republicans, everyone was united, beating on the Fed to keep interest rates down.
That's exactly
and
right.
Almost the entire, economics profession was joining in. It wasn't until the end of the year, 1972, that you know, the employment numbers began to come down. So things looked very different afterwards. But at the time, there couldn't have been more than a handful of people like Friedman who were offering other advice. And people, of course,
I remember
that,
we got a letter from Milton Friedman once.
Yes, yeah, so you published that in your review. That was right after I came, because when I was in graduate school, we talked about that letter.
Mm-hmm.
We worked the letter at the Money Workshop,
mm-hmm.
and then I came to Richmond, and you had.
Yeah.
Just published it, so that was very
nice. But I remember
nice.
One of the things that he said in that letter was that what good is the independence of the Fed if the Fed won't use that independence, you know? the fact of the matter is that the Fed cannot be independent.
Well, that, I mean...
That's what I had in mind when I said, you know, Burns looking from inside, and it looks a little bit different from inside when you, you know, have to deal with that Congress, have to deal with the Treasury, and... You know, while we think of ourselves as independent of the Treasury, we are not independent. We still have to, you know. So.
Well, I mean, that's right. I mean, when the chairman wants to raise interest rates, he has to make sure that the political system can't form a coalition to take our independence away. So he has to have either the Treasury or the Senate or the House banking
or the economics
chairman.
Profession. Is
somebody's got to be... On his side. On the other hand, I remember thinking kind of vividly at the time that if Burns weren't an intellectual elitist, if he didn't have this feeling that he towered over everyone, if he thought he could go and make his case to the public for inflation. We could have pushed much harder, but he was never willing to go directly to the public. He didn't trust the public. He always thought that he could play off people within the political system.
I think there's a lot to that notion.
And Volcker really changed the character of the Fed in that respect, where Volcker would begin talking directly to public opinion and taking full advantage of the media attention that the Fed received. And, Burns didn't do that, and I think if he had Volcker's personality, if he'd been willing to go directly to the media, I think he could have. I don't think the country would have thrown this to the wolves.
Well, Burns, as I say, was a very interesting individual. I think there's a lot to what you say about it. He was a pedagogue, in the better sense of the term. But I remember. You know, the University of South Carolina gave him an honorary degree and had him down there as a commencement speaker. I forget what year it was, but anyway, they invited me down there as well. And I remember they had a reception for him at the Palmetto Club there in Columbia. And it just happens that Helen has a little nephew who lived in Atlanta at the time, and he was going to Georgia State University there. He was a great admirer of Burns, and he came over from Atlanta to Columbia in the hopes that I could introduce him to Burns. And sure enough, he was standing outside the Palmetto Club there, and I went out to see him, and I said, let me go in and see if I can catch the chairman and see if he'll meet you. But I happened to catch the chairman by himself there, and I went up to him, and I said, Mr. Chairman, I have who would give his right arm to come in and shake your hand. And Burns said, why, bring him on. So I went out and got Georgie and brought him in, and Georgie, that was a highlight of Georgie's life. It still is, you know.
Oh, sure.
But he did have some degree of magnanimity about him.
He was a gentleman.
He was a gentleman.
Presence. And,
absolutely.
I mean, Milton Friedman said at his funeral, where Burns sat at the table, that was the head of the table.
That's right.
And when he walked into a room, there was Arthur Burns, and then there was everybody else.
Was everybody.
He had that presence, but I wonder if he didn't feel like he could exert a control that really wasn't feasible for one person to exert. That, you know, he was a student of American politics, and he felt like he knew enough about the system that he could guide the Fed through, when he really should have kind of decided, well, you know, what are my principles? If it's inflation, then, you know, that's what we're going to concentrate on, and I'm going to take my case to the American people. And
He should have taken it to the American people, but, you know, again, he just didn't have that popular kind of charisma like Martin had, for example. Or I don't think Volcker has an awful lot of it, but Volcker can be very effective, and I mean, and I think Burns could have been, too. But, you know, he was getting some age on him, too, Bob. I remember when he first came to be introduced there, and Martin introduced him and all, and Burns, when he got up, he said, well, this is a very interesting system that I'm joining. He says it's a system. Some people leave it when they're 66, and some people come in when they're 66. So Burns was 66 years old when Martin retired, and I don't know how that affected his physical energy. Sometimes I thought he could be a little bit mean.
He could be vindictive.
He didn't care for the New York Bank for some reason or other. I don't know whether he remembered, you know, Benjamin Strong influenced the New York Bank, but he wanted to be sure that.
Al Hayes.
That's right. Sometimes I thought he could be downright insulting to Al Hayes and to Pete Sternlight, all the desk people. Although I thought Alan Holmes always handled himself very well in dealing with that. I think Burns had a lot of respect for Alan. But he did pay a lot of attention to Charlie Coombs. Charlie Coombs was a very interesting person, and he played a very historic role, I think, in the systems programs, currency programs, that sort of thing. Kind of Milton Friedman would approve by him.
I read
but,
some.
Burns, I remember at one dinner meeting day, we had some guests, among them Chairman Martin. And old timers.
Sure, oh yeah. Absolutely.
Burns got up and he started, he said, I'm going to introduce somebody who had really meant so much to the system and made such great contributions to the system and all. And we all thought he was going to introduce Chairman Martin. And he introduced Randy Burgess instead. And didn't mention a thing about Martin, which I thought was very unmagnanimous. I say he was a very interesting individual, and a lot of, and I think vindictive is the right word. Well, anyway,
I mean, he wanted to run the system. There was not a Federal Reserve system. I think
you're right.
Whenever issues become very political, then the system tends to centralize. That's the pressure.
Well, he was a hell of a lot better than what Carter replaced him with.
Miller.
Miller was a cipher. I mean, he didn't know. Strangely enough, I think Miller was pretty popular with the board staff because, you know, the board staff could really strut its stuff under a guy like Miller. And boy, they couldn't do that with Burns.
Yeah, I remember when Miller was appointed staff circulated I think it was a Newsweek interview where Miller had said that reserve requirements are imposed on bank assets, not liabilities.
Mm.
So he certainly had some things to learn.
Oh, he had plenty to learn. He was completely miscast. Just completely miscast. And anyway,
it is ironic. I mean, if Burns had been reappointed, history would have been very different. On the other hand, Burns was trying to be reappointed.
Yes, he was trying to be reappointed.
And so he was trying to walk that line
again.
Right. He told, it was like 65, Burns told Carter that, rates are going to have to go up. Burns.
Yeah, right, you're right.
And he did raise rates right before his reappointment was up. So in that sense, he did the right thing, and this was an open signal, and he wasn't reappointed. On the other hand, he did put off, for 6 months.
That's right. It should have gone up. There's no question about that. Well, very, very interesting. And then we brought Mr. Volcker. A great deal, I think, to restore the public image of the system. But, a lot was going on at the same time, Bob. As I was saying to you the other day, throughout the 50s and the 60s, the early 60s in particular, the Fed didn't have a very good image among professional economists. We came under a great deal of criticism in the 50s and the early 60s from the professional. And we weren't doing a lot of very interesting research then either. We began to pull in some very good people in the 1960s. But a lot of those people like DeLeo were concerned with these big Tinbergen type models,
Sure.
Great models of the economy. They were very clever economists. Jim Pierce, for the most part, they were. They had broken the neoclassical range, and had gone off in other macroeconomic directions.
I remember the debate over intervention in the foreign exchange market that took place in 1961. I became involved in that. Do you remember that at all?
We used to talk about changes in the exchange rate structure at a lot of the meetings of the System Committee on that.
This was the Exchange Stabilization Fund had been basically lending its money to Latin American countries, and then it didn't have resources to intervene in the foreign exchange market. And the Treasury obviously didn't want to go to Congress to get authorization, so the Fed was under pressure. I've written that up, and I just wondered if you had recollections from that.
I'd like to see what you've written up. Okay. I'll send that to you. Of those things. I remember that the Fed was really becoming very much involved in international discussions. Mm-hmm. And I remember Stan Siegel had gone off to Stan Siegel and Fred Klopstock. You remember?
Yes, they were interested in the Eurodollar market.
That's right, that's right. And I don't remember if this was engineering.
Yeah, okay.
And, I think the swap arrangements that Charlie engineered were probably part of this.
Yes. Oh, yeah. That was the debate.
Exchange stabilization.
Yeah.
The Exchange Stabilization Fund, was established back in 34.
Well, 34. 34 was. That was part of the business that Carter Glass didn't want the New York Fed to be a central bank. Mm-hmm. They wanted to take. They didn't want New York Fed lending to the Bank of England. Mm-hmm. So they put it under the control of the Treasury. And the board, at that point, the board went along with it. They didn't want New York to be a central bank either. Okay.
Well, it's very interesting to go over all of this.